This could be an interesting talk for perhaps people also working in quantum information theory here at Perimeter, and I don't know how many of them are here. Anyway, it's supposedly a talk that is perhaps a little directed at them as well, but we'll see. So anyway, what is different in quantum theory? If you look at Wikipedia or look at old papers and see what the greats of quantum physics had to say about it, then Heisenberg, I think I took this from his famous paper, 1926 paper, if there were to exist experiments allowing for simultaneous measurement of P and Q exceeding in precision what corresponds to the uncertainty relation, then quantum theory would be impossible. Obviously, he's the inventor of the uncertainty relation, so he's clear. It's not surprising he thinks that's fundamental. Dirac didn't like to talk very much, so he just said that. And then Schrödinger, in a very well-known quote, said that I would not call entanglement one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. So you take your pick, which you think is most characteristic of quantum mechanics. In a sense, they're of course all related to each other, but here I'll focus on entanglement, obviously. So what is entanglement? Entanglement concerns subsystems, usually two in my talk two, but you could have three or four or whatever number of an ambient system, and it roughly, you ask how much information can you extract about the state, the given state of the total system by performing separately local coordinate operations on A and B. So that's, just words. So I want to point out that entanglement is not the same as correlation. So often people say we mix up the two a little bit, in my experience. So they use the terms as if they meant the same, but it's clearly not the same. So you can obviously have lots of correlations in classical physics. So for instance, if you prepare an ensemble of cards and you, for each pair, both cards are either black or both are white, and then you hand out a pair, one of each to A and the other to B, then A knows that if he uncovers one of his cards at random, he'll get with probability P, one white, and with probability and with P black and white with one minus P. But obviously the ensembles are maximally correlated, but that has absolutely nothing to do with entanglement. So classical correlations have nothing to do with entanglement. I think this clearly shows. Before I want to get started, just wanted to recall the standard grammar of quantum theory. It's what you find in textbooks. So observables are, I'm going to use it, little letters A, and you think of them as operators on a Hilbert space, and states, you know, or you can think of as statistical operators. I just warn you that I'll use this notation here sometimes, where I think of a state as acting on an observable. It's just a notation that you should have in the back of your mind, this. And so a pure state is a representation independent. The definition is a state that cannot be written as non-trivially as a convex combination of other states, and otherwise it's called mixed. And independent systems means that you have a Hilbert space or tensor. Hilbert has a tensor structure, and then the observables for A are by axiom the ones that act on the first one, and the ones for B that act on the second one. So that's how you set up independent systems in quantum mechanics. And measurement, you all know this. So your possible outcomes of measuring an observable A are, of course, its eigenvalues, and the probability of measuring an eigenvalue lambda n is you can write as this trace. It's trace P, the eigenprojection, onto the eigenvector rho Pn. So immediately afterwards, you say that the state now is in. It has collapsed, so the wave packet, you're afterwards, you say you're in this state, you're in this eigenstate of the operator A. So there are some states, if you have, well, usually we're now going to have this tensor product structure And if you have a state like this, which is a density operator on A tensored with a density operator on B, you call that a separable state. It's just a definition. And so so now what is entanglement? So let's first think classically. So what if you have a bipartite system, then you have that corresponds to the analog corresponds to just a Cartesian product of the phase spaces. And a state is just a probability density, so probability density on this product. But you can write this kind of density always as a sum of separable density. So separable means that probability density classically is separable if it's just a product of a density for A and another one for B. So you can write any one you want as a convex combination of this. And so in quantum theory, that's not possible. That's the mystery of it, or that's the special feature of quantum mechanics. And so you just say a state is entangled if it's not separable. It's a not very interesting definition, but the point is, of course, that in classical physics, every state is separable. So in some sense, it's closely related to the fact that if you have a mixed state, you cannot uniquely decompose it into pure state. So it's an ambiguity, and that is closely related. So these are all very, I'm sure, people from quantum information. I don't tell them anything new here. These are just basic definitions. So example is if you take the C2 as your Hilbert spaces, and then this kind of state is called a belt state. It's a 0 across 0 plus 1 plus 1. So this one is entangled, and it's actually, it turns out, in a sense, maximally entangled. So you can't have anything that's more entangled. And in n dimensions, so then when the Hilbert space is n dimensions, you can do something similar. You can just, instead of just 0, 0 plus 1, 1, you can define a state this way with a suitable normalization factor. And this, again, is in a sense maximally entangled. Now, if you have infinite dimensions, you can't do it because then you can no longer normalize it. But you can still take a state where you put some constant Cj here in front, and you have to let them go to zero. Otherwise, you can't normalize this. So you don't know what kind of prefactor to put here. So, if you make these Cn's, if you take these values here where Ej is the jth eigenvalue of some Hamiltonian, then you get something that comes up in the Unruh effect typically. So where you get well, this is a version of the Unruh effect that you have split your system in two, then you have an entangled state with this kind of distribution of numbers. Okay, now let's say if a state is entangled, then it's easy to see that it has to be correlated. So correlated just means that if you have let the state on a product of operators, one from A, one from B, that's not equal to the product of the expectation. But the converse is not usually true. So if you have correlation, so if that is, if you have, if that inequality holds, then the state may nevertheless be unentangled. So again, this is showing again that correlations a priori have nothing to do with entanglement. Now you'd like to measure entanglement. So I've been talking about maximally entangled, but what does it mean maximally? You obviously got to have some measure to say one is more entangled than another. And historically, to my knowledge, the first such measure was what is called Bell correlation. So for my entangled measures, I always use this E. And because there are many of them, I'm going to put a subscript which one I mean. So the Bell correlation that's the following thing. So you take observables from A, and and from B, so they're Hermitian operators, so their eigenvalues are between minus 1 and plus 1 each. And then you look at this kind of combination here, and you take the maximum that you can get here. I mean, you can't make it arbitrarily large because the eigenvalues are bounded from above and below, and you call that the entanglement. And it turns out that, for instance, this particular combination is the clever one that essentially Bell guessed, and the idea is pretty. It's not so easy to see just from this formula, but the idea is that in this combination, somehow the classical correlations cancel out, and so you're left with this with something that measures just the entanglement. Okay, so what can you do with it? I mean, this is all all stuff. So, for instance, previously, of course, people thought it was a kind of a strange thing, and they thought of this being sort of counter indicative that there was something wrong with quantum mechanics. But of course, sometimes in the early 90s, people sort of started turning this around, and they discovered that you can use entanglement as a resource for doing interesting things that are not possible classically. So, for instance, one example is this old idea of teleportation. So, suppose you take you want to teleport a state in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, so you can parameterize all the pure states in this way, sort of a Bloch sphere or whatever it's called. And suppose you want to teleport that from A to B. Then you want to bring that state from A to B, but you assume you can only transmit classical information. So you're only allowed to transmit two bits of classical information. So you have a phone line, you're allowed to say 0011 or whatever to the guy from B. And so how are you going to teleport this state? So they came up with this idea that you use an entangled state to do that for you, and the way it works, I'm just explaining, this is not the main point of my talk, but I'm explaining to motivate some of the other things that I'll talk about. So you choose a so-called Bell basis of this tensor product, so HA is both two-dimensional sort of spin-up, spin-down Hilbert spaces, and then you prepare, you add a third system to this called C, and then you take your state, so A takes the state that he wants to teleport, and then he tensors that with a Bell state. So you get then a state for system ABC, and then some given observable whose eigenvectors are four Bells, so are the four Bell eigenstates, so you can easily cook something up like this. You measure that for the system AC, and then afterwards, of course, after you've measured it, the system AC is in one of the four eigenstates of this operator, and so you can easily show then that you can write the state after that as unitaries times these eigenstates, one of these Bell eigenstates. So you then A just says which of the eigenstates he got, whether it's the one labeled 00, 10, 01, or 11, and then he goes on the phone and he tells that to B, and then B just applies, in essence, the inverse of this unitary to the state and reads out what beta is, basically. So that's how this teleportation works, and entanglement comes in because you need this Bell state here to set everything up. Bell state and Campbell state. And so that brings me, that's supposed to motivate what one means by having more or less entanglement. And so what you basically want to do, you want to say, how can you increase entanglement? So you could say, so when am I more rich than you? You know, sometimes difficult to measure, because you could list certain operations that will definitely make me richer or poorer. So if I lose $100, then I'm definitely poorer afterwards. It's not so you just list these operations that will definitely make you richer or poorer. And here the idea is you list the operations that you say definitely will increase or decrease entanglement. And so what are these operations? So you can apply a time evolution. So you apply I'm in the kind of Heisenberg picture where time evolution is the sandwich of your observables with some unitary U, and you can add an ancillary system here, or you can make a von Neumann measurement, what I explained, so that projects onto some eigenstate. And you can do arbitrary combinations of these. And it's those arbitrary combinations that are characterized by some math stuff. They give so-called completely positive maps. So you don't, it's just to motivate this. And so then with the operations, so that's called a channel. And so the operations you want to do are the ones where you apply one such completely positive map separately on each system. And you allow yourself to also do sums of this. So this acts on the observables from A and B, and sort of the algebras of these observables. So these are called separable operations, and so I wanted to go through this, but maybe I won't. So you can rephrase this quantum teleportation just as a sequence of such kind of separable operations. So before I said what you do on the states, but you can equally, by switching from the Schrödinger picture to the Heisenberg picture, you can equally say what you do to the operators, and then you can easily see it's just trivialities that this you. Adding this kind of teleportation protocol really is at each step one of these operations. So the teleportation is a kind of example of subsequent applications of such kind of separable operations. I'm just the separable operations for me act on the observable, so I'm thinking in terms of the Heisenberg picture, but you can also think of them by duality in terms of the Schrödinger picture. And have them act on states, it doesn't matter. So a definition of entanglement measure should be as follows. So why do I think of these operations as a decreasing entanglement? Because you can show that no separable state can be mapped to an entangled state by such an operation. So if you have a separable state and you do this under these operations, you're never going to get an entangled state. So it just goes one way. And also you can show that every entangled state can be obtained from a maximally entangled state by one of these operations. So I think of these operations as definitely decreasing my entanglement. So it's like the losing the $100, that operation is not usually voluntary, but if I throw it out of the window, then that operation will decrease my wealth, and so these separable operations decrease entanglement. So that's how you define an entanglement measure. It's just a functional that gives you a number for each state, and this functional should be that it always decreases when you apply one of these separable operations. So it's like you apply a wealth measure, and then it should sort of decrease when I lose $100. And so this is the kind of same thing that here you say this, whatever it is, it should never increase under such a separable operation. And actually, this is a little bit of a stronger requirement because you can do these separable operations sort of at random, so statistically. And so this is really saying that on average, you never gain by performing them. And then it should have the property that it's non-negative, that's just more or less a convention. And it should give zero precisely on the separable states. So it should not have the property that it returns some entanglement if the state was, in fact, separable. So there are various other things that you could impose like subadditivity or whatever. But these are really the main ones. Okay, so I wanted to say, give you then a few examples of such measures, and then none of them, well, most of them are not particularly new. And so one is the following, is called the relative entanglement entropy. And what you do is you have your state, you have your tripartite system, and you have your state. And then you measure the distance to the set of separable states. So the separable state should have no entanglement by definition. So if you measure the distance to the set of all separable states, that should be a good measure of entanglement. But what, as this, you got to choose something reasonable as your distance to preserve this monotonicity I was talking about. And one possible choice is here to choose for the distance, the relative entropy. So it's the minimum over the relative entropy between the given state and any separable state. So that's what it's called. Okay, so there is another one that's very popular. It's called distillable entanglement. And you just say you take your state and you apply your separable operations. Actually, you take your state and you allow yourself to have n copies of your system. And then you apply any suitable separable operations to extract Bell pairs, because Bell pairs are kind of the standard currency in this business. Sort of a Bell pair has sort of one unit of entanglement. So you ask how much of the standard currency you can extract by these separable operations. And of course, you can extract arbitrarily much, because if you allow yourself many, many copies, so you got to just normalize by the number of copies. And that's, you also take a logarithm. That's called the distillable entanglement. And a very popular one here in quantum field theory is the so-called von Neumann measure. So that's the people usually just know this one, but you take, the way it works is you take a partial trace of your state to either subsystem A or B, and then you just compute the von Neumann entropy of this. Okay, so similarly, you could do something like this. This is called mutual information, where you do, where you take not the, so agent von Neumann entropy, where you take this kind of combination. So the point is that both of these are not really reasonable entangled measures, except for pure states. So if you have pure states, then this is a good entangled measure in the sense that it has this monotonicity, and it vanishes only if the state is separable. But if you have a non-pure state, this is just not it doesn't have these properties that you want. So the Bell correlations are another example. I've already given that definition before. You can do also something like this. You can take your state, and then you try to dominate it by a separable function, a separable non-normalized density matrix. And you can take the trace of this and the minimum of that, and the log of the minimum will give you a measure how not separable your state is. And my last example is modular theory or something. And I don't really have time here to explain. It is based on the so-called modular operator of the state relative to this decomposition of the system into A and B, and that's I want to call EM. It's, again, some logarithm of some index. There are many other examples known in the quantum information literature. I'm going to kind of fill pages and pages and pages of this. I just have listed a few because I'm going to work with some of them later. So now let me go back to if you have so many, maybe they're all perhaps secretly the same. So they all satisfy these, except for the von Neumann one, they all more or less satisfy these properties that you want. So maybe they're actually the same. And in fact, for pure states, that's actually true. So there is a standard a theorem, which is, I guess, well known in this community, that for pure states, basically up to some you know, technical requirements, all entanglement measures are the same as the von Neumann entropy. So whatever, the definition may look very different, but they all give the same number. But the point is that for mixed states, that's just no longer true. And I'll explain to you in just a second, I think in quantum field theory, you're essentially always in this situation. So, well, here is some relationships you can establish between these quantities. So for pure states, they're all the same. But for instance, for mixed states, this ED is typically the smallest, and ER is less than this, and so on. You can prove this kind of stuff. OK, so now I want to come to quantum field theory, which is actually the title of my talk. And of course, I realize that here at Perimeter, people have worked a lot on entanglement, Rob Myers, if he's here, or his group, certainly. And so this is certainly much later, so I don't want to repeat what these people did and or criticize it. I just want to provide a different viewpoint here or something, say something that's maybe different from, not contradicting it, but just giving you a different viewpoint. And so now I'm going to specialize to the situation. So what I've said before is just totally general to any all kind of quantum system. But for quantum field theory, the difference is that you're always sort of the subsystem is usually tied with the localization in space-time. So that's the characteristic of quantum field theory. So usually you say, okay, you have space-time, so you have space and time, and then the observables localized, you know, measurable in some region A by the relativistic kinematics that actually coincide with the observables that you could measure in some sort of causal diamond, as it's called. So the systems, the subsystems are associated with such a kind of causal diamonds. So that's the relativists know this because this is the causal completion. So you know everything here, you know everything in the causal completion. And so the observables measurable in one region A, I'm going to call A for algebra sub A. And that they were basically generated by the quantum fields localized at points in there. And so you have this the usual relativistic rule that if the regions A and B are space-like related, then these observables all mutually commute with each other. And so the algebra of all observables for a pair of regions A and B is just that one that you generate by it. And so so here is a technical point which is important when you go from sort of finite dimensional systems or quantum mechanical systems, not necessarily finite, to quantum field theory. And the difference is the following. So you know that for space-like related A and B, these operators mutually commute. But that does not mean technically that this is not technically the same, although it's morally the same, but not really the same as saying that the algebra that you have generated is a tensor product. So there's a subtle difference between that. It all has to do with infinite dimensions. But the physical reason is that you may have boundary effects. And the boundary effects preclude that this is equal to that. And there is a mass reason also that has to do with the type of the algebra that you have in this game. They have a certain type according to a famous classification by mathematicians in the 70s. And this kind of type is responsible for it at a technical level. So the basic conclusion is that, for instance, if the regions A and B touch each other, then you don't have this kind of product structure. And therefore, you don't have any product state. And therefore, you don't have any separable states. And therefore, you don't even know what you're talking about. Because you define entanglement by saying that something is not separable, but what if there are simply no separable states? If, on the other hand, the regions A and B, they don't touch, then there are no pure states because you have an intermediate region. And clearly, due to this intermediate region, your state can never be pure. And so therefore, if we want to discuss sort of without imposing cutoffs, you could introduce cutoffs, of course, in your field theory, and sort of put it on a lattice or something. And then you're getting around all of this. But if you don't want to impose a cutoff, you have to either, if you want a finite amount of entanglement, you must accept that A and B cannot touch each other. So you have to got to leave a safety corridor between your subsets. And if you have the safety corridor, then your state is not pure. Yes?
I'm not sure if I understand. Is a safety corridor different than having cutoff?
No, yeah, so what I mean, if this is A, and you wanna take B, you can't take B as the complement of A. You gotta leave this. That's what I mean by a safety corridor. So it's morally like a cutoff. But I think when people use a replica trick or something like that, they don't do it that way. They impose a cutoff, let's say, in momentum space, or you can, on a lattice, there is no problem anyhow. And then they let B be, for instance, the complement of A. But then you have a thing that's going to diverge upon removal of the cutoff. Does that answer your question? Or?
Right, but I don't see what's wrong with having a Hilbert space on B and A and just removing that ring from the space-time as a cutoff, and then I can still define H A times H B, right? I can still make a...
Well, if you have a cutoff, if you have in the presence of a cutoff, yes, I'm pointing out that without, if you want to have the situation that A is this and B is the complement of A, then I'm saying that without a cutoff, the Hilbert space, although you intuitively think that the Hilbert space ought to be a tensor product, I'm telling you that in reality it isn't because of the boundary effects.
Okay.
But in this case, it is. Okay? Is that answer your question?
I think I'll let you go on. I just want to see what the difference between a finite corridor and that cutoff, because it sounds like it's
simply. I don't have a cutoff. I never have a cutoff. Okay, but I'm just saying that morally, your corridor is like a cutoff, morally speaking. But of course, there's no reason to choose. You could also take A here and B here. And you could ask, what's the entanglement? That's also an interesting question. If they're far apart, obviously the entanglement, you expect it to go to zero, but exactly how and so on. Yeah? So this, I'm just saying you've got to have some sort of finite distance. Otherwise, you have no tensor product structure, and then you have no separable states, and then you don't really know what you actually mean by not entangled. Did I say this?
Yeah. Was it?
Yeah. Okay. So now, of course, what one has in mind typically.
Are you saying that? Another way of saying your point is that if you do introduce a cutoff, then the algebra. If you do introduce a cutoff,
yeah.
Then the algebra is type one.
Type one, or it depends if it's a infinite spin system, type two, or something. Then it's no problem.
Whereas the algebra without cutoff is
type one.
Necessarily type.
Always type one. But I think there were. It's just. I don't necessarily criticize imposing cutoffs. I'm not saying that's bad. I just want to say if you want to be in a really clean setup where we really mean what's an entangled measure is a monotone under certain operations, you've got to have a certain framework. Of course, you can calculate things with cutoff. That's of course completely legitimate and interesting, etc. But I'm just pointing out that then whatever your result you have is not clear. What are its conceptual properties? Or is it going to be monotone under separable operations? What does it even mean, separable operations, if you impose a momentum space cutoff where you lose strict localizations and those kinds of issues?
Also, I guess at the most naive level, when you want to take the cutoff away, when you want to take the cutoff in, then you would like to make sure that the quantum field system that you're looking at goes over to a type 3, which is not always right. Easy to check.
Yeah, so maybe let me compare this kind of framework to what is often done with cutoffs and so on in the very end. I'm not saying it's all wrong. I just want to maybe give you a perspective to think about. I'm not saying everyone else is doing nonsense. I just want to maybe get some basic points across, and then maybe we can talk about it. Okay, so that's what you typically, historically, people were thinking about. And I'm pointing out to you, if you really want to work in the theory without cutoff, you've got to leave some corridor there. Now, I wanted to, I think I've already made those points, but now I've just more or less just given you some abstract stuff, and I wanted to tell you a few things that you can actually show with this, and maybe then it's becoming a little more concrete, hopefully. And so we looked at these various kinds of theories. So we looked at what are called integrable models in one plus one dimensions, and then we looked at what you could say about CFTs in d plus one dimensions. And then there is, of course, this thing everyone knows called the area law, and I wanted to explain to you how this comes out, a very intuitive way to see this. And then you have a free field example. So free fields you always usually think of as trivial, but of course, if you're talking about things like entanglement, you're talking about finding traces of density matrices to some functions of density matrices. Of course, that means you have to know the eigenvalues of these reduced density matrices. Of course, it's, even for free fields, it's a very far from trivial problem. And then I wanted to talk about what are called charge states, and then what gives you some general bounds. So the rest of the talk are kind of these results, and I don't have time to explain the methods. But so first of all, what are these integrable models? So I want to really think of them as, want to really define the algebras of operators, because that's what is the relevant thing here for entanglement. But what you need something to define them. So what you usually do is you say that what their two-body S matrix is. And because by integrable models, by construction in one plus one dimension, so pretty much, or one where the n-body S matrix factorizes, and you want just so the simplest case is where the S matrix is actually is parameterized by a theta. That's the rapidity parameter. So you write you can write it in terms of the Mandelstam variable, but you can also just theta is easier. And then just the simplest case where the S matrix is just a phase, and a typical case where that works is where you have these so-called these factors here, and you have a product of these factors. So for instance, if you have just one such factor, you get the so-called Sinch-Gordon model. People know this. And so these parameters B here are related, are sort of coupling constants or whatever they define the model. And then there is a nice way to define these algebras for the left and the right wedge using sort of the properties like the Young-Baxter equation and so on, and the crossing symmetry and so on of this S matrix that I don't have time to for, but you can concretely then define what these algebras of observables are. And I put manifestly a distance, little r, between them. So my A and B are these regions, the blue one and the red one. And the result is that if you have a large distance here between them, so if you have A here and B there, but they're very far apart, then the entanglement of the vacuum state decays with e to the minus mr, basically, a little less. Never mind. And so the constants here, they depend on the scattering matrix. And so on the other hand, if they're very close to each other, so more like this kind of situation. Of course, I'm in one plus one dimension, so I'm just have one spatial dimension here. Then up to some complicated bound, which we think is true, checked extensively numerically, but K can't really prove it, but it looks like the short distance behavior is like log m times r. So m is the mass of the field, and r is the distance to some exponent alpha.
Sorry, which one of the measures are you using here?
What?
Which one of the measures? You had several measures.
So this is ER. This is the one on based on the relative entanglement entropy. Very good question. So any one that is less like the distillable entropy would then automatically upper bound it as well. So let me say, I know that physicists really love to compute equality. You know, that's of course the greatest thing, but I can't quite do this. So the other one is this, and then there is this one. All I can do, because it's a basically a very hard problem, I can only do this one. And this is sort of Russian style Euler, whatever this is, mathematical physics, and this is California style or whatever. Now let me talk a little bit about CFTs. And so here I want to take my region A to be a diamond, but which is possibly boosted. And I want to take my region B to be the causal complement of some larger diamond. Yeah? So B is not that diamond, but it's the causal complement of it. So they're space-like related. And so you see that the geometry of the situation is characterized by four points, namely the tip and the bottom of this the larger double cone, and the tip and the bottom of the smaller double cone. So these are four points. And if you have four points, you want to form the conformally invariant cross ratios, of which there are two. They're usually called U and V. And from this U and V, you can define some two other parameters, theta and tau, in this way, it's an algebraic manner. And then you can show that this relative entanglement of the vacuum state in this theory is at least not bigger than some sort of partition function. So it's some sort of conformal partition function where the sum is over all conformal primaries of the theory. So you know conformal primary, in conformal field theory you can organize your local operators in terms of primaries and descendants. And here in the sum, I'm just summing over all primaries, and then here is the dimension of the primary, and S here is the spin of the primary. So they have in four dimensions, you have a dimension and a spin.
So in this case, one seems nested inside the other.
No, it's the causal complement. So it's, I think, it's easier draw in two dimensions. So B would be something like this, and A would be something like this.
So the distance now is marked by this capital R.
So the distance is somehow encoded in these cross ratios. The relative position is somehow encoded in these cross ratios. So in fact, if you choose them without the boost, just concentric, then the leading contribution for very large. So it's really the ratio between the sizes of the diamonds in a conformal field theory. Only, of course, only thing that can enter are ratios of dimensionful things. And you see that it's dominated by the multiplicity of the operator with the smallest dimension and this ratio. So it's R over R to the D. The operator of the smallest dimension, not the identity operator. So for free scalar field, that D would be 1, basically. For a free fermion, it would be 3/2. So here is this is the simple case where A is this and B is the complement. And then R is this and little r is this. And so now I wanted to talk a little bit about the area law. So the idea here with the area law is that you can put little subsystems across from the boundary here. That's the kind of idea, and you can say that the distillable entropy, entanglement of this whole set of subsystems is going to be equal to the sum of the distillable entropy. So basically, because the relative entanglement.
So sorry to interrupt. Can I ask a quick question about the CFD thing?
Yeah.
You said there were two independent cross ratios.
Yeah.
But up to Mobius transformations, isn't there only one?
Or? On a chiral, on a light ray, there's just one. But on 4D, so if you have two light rays, so in 1 plus 1, you have one cross ratio for a light ray, other cross ratio for the other light.
Okay.
But it, in any dimensions, you have two. Okay, so the area law is a lower bound, and it comes about, it's, well, the bound is at any rate for a small distance epsilon between the two regions. It's the area, the bounding area, divided by epsilon to the appropriate power to make this dimensionless. And then it's, there is a prefactor d2, which is the distillable entanglement of this elementary qubit, c-bit pair, I call it. So what this is, you basically say, well, the intuitive idea is a quantum field is a collection of a lot of oscillators. And so I choose one of these oscillators localized here and another of this oscillator localized there. So then I have two entangled oscillators if I restrict the state to this. And then I ask how much entanglement can I distill from this. And that's this number d2. And that depends on the model, but you can always show it's always positive. It's always, it's never zero. You get a similar result here for in one spatial dimension instead of a power is a log. It's a, usual kind of thing. But here is a D2. So D2, if you have n copies of a field, then D2 here scales with n, for example, because there are n times as many c-bit pairs. And so now free field theories, again, are something that you can look at because you can, again, of course, you can define them in principle without problems. And so here you have a result, again, when the regions become close to each other, then this entanglement measure ER of the ground state, possibly curved space, is given by a logarithm times a series of inverse powers of R, which, and the highest power, the most singular one, again, gives the area law, and the lower ones are some curvature invariants associated with the boundary. Such formulas have been established a long time ago using this replica method, where this then related to the coefficients in the heat kernel expansion. So this is a bit different in the sense that here I'm trying to just get an upper bound on something which really has a finite different distance between them. So it's a kind of different but morally related result. And if, again, the distance between the regions is large, then, again, you're going to have some exponential decay. So then the entanglement goes to zero exponentially.
Question. So is the comparison to the case when you put a UV cut off is to make that corridor very small, like you did in the previous slide?
Well, let me just maybe comment on that in the very end, perhaps. So because I don't think it's that obvious what the sort of morally speaking, this distance, if the distance is small, it's like a UV cutoff, morally. But I think if you want to say in more detail what exactly is supposed to be equal here in what limit, then that's more not so easy to say. And maybe I can come back to that later.
Can you explain again what is the meaning of field equalities? I mean, what is the...
Oh, this means when the distance becomes very small, then this is asymptotically less than this quantity on the right side. So if you want a precise definition, there exists a delta such that for blah, blah, blah. But it means this is for sufficiently small r, this is less than that, roughly. And this means for sufficiently large r, this is less than that.
For sufficiently small r, this yeah. Would be
well, inequality. So I only have inequalities here. I can't do the equality. I'd love to do the equality. So that's why I'm giving you upper and lower bounds to sort of give you some idea. Usually, just rigorous, unfortunately, I can't give you equalities. I'd love to, but I can't. Okay. But it's sort of supposed to explain the qualitative behavior. So I think these are basically sharp. So this is probably inequality in some sense with some constant, but I can't show this because it's too complicated. Okay, so this should be a is sort of the situation, basically. So now I want to get to the end. I wanted to now not want to ask the following question. Suppose I have a state, and I have two subsystems, A and B, and suppose I add a bunch of charges to this state. Okay, so I apply some charge-carrying operators to this state, so to speak. And so I ask, how is the entanglement? So I'm going to keep my partition of A to B fixed. I'm going to ask, how is the entanglement going to change? And so I call the state with the charges chi added. I give it this suggested notation. There will be some kind of rigorous definitions, but I don't have time, or I don't think you're very would be that interested in them. So what I want to point out is that the adding charges always decreases the entanglement, but it doesn't decrease it so much. So it decreases it at most by log of the product of the quantum dimensions of the charges. So the dim is if you have a charge, you can assign to it in a canonical way a dimension. So if you have a charged field transforming in the fundamental representation, there's charge under SUN, and it's in the fundamental representation of SUN, then applying this kind of charge-carrying field with one color index would give you a state would be associated to N as the quantum dimension, which in that case is equal to the actual dimension of the representation. But it's well known that in two dimensions, this quantum dimension of the charge does not have to be an integer or something like that. In fact,
are these charges in the gauge theory, or are they global charges?
There will be global charges. So let me give you an example. So if you have a minimal model in 1 plus 1 dimensions of the P plus 1 minimal model, and then in the minimal model, you have charges of so-called type NM. You look at this CFT books of Zubair and whatever, DiFrancesco and et al. You can read it all, and then you know what these charge states then correspond to inequivalent representations of the Virasoro algebra, and in that case the quantum dimension is well known to be the sine function. So you see, it doesn't have to be integer. So it's kind of this kind of complicated function. So for instance, if you have a theory in D greater than one. If you have a charge-carrying field that transforms under some Young-Tableau type diagram. So I gave you the example of the fundamental representation, but you can have a field with many color indices which are symmetrized and anti-symmetrized in some Young-Tableau fashion, and then you can, for instance, for this Young-Tableau, you get you don't decrease it by more than 2 times log of 5 million, blah, blah, blah. So it's that kind of. Okay, so then at the very end, I wanted to say something, some sort of general things. So these were mostly models, but you can say a few things in quite generality using various tricks. And for instance, if you just know that the theory is massive, then automatically the relative entanglement of the vacuum state has to decay sub-exponentially. So I think probably exponentially, but here you can just show that it's almost exponentially with the exponent slightly less than one. And for a thermal state, you can show this kind of behavior where alpha is some constant that has to do with the spectral property of the property of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in the thermal representation. Okay, let me summarize and then maybe say something about this relation with the other methods in the event, but I need to do that on the board. I explained what entanglement is and how it can be used, what an entangled measure is. I explained how entanglement, I alluded to how entanglement arises in quantum field theory. I evaluated some upper and lower bounds in some concrete models, unfortunately. No equalities here. And then I pointed out this relative entanglement entropy is particularly natural. So it has these properties that I mentioned, but it has a ton more other properties. And so it's particularly pretty also in this type 1, type 3, 1 vector. I showed how the area law rises endum. I think it would be interesting, maybe that brings me to the end. There is, of course, this huge literature of things people have calculated. So for instance, in 2D, there are these pioneering papers by Calabrese, Cardi, and these people have, for instance, also worked out charge states. And then there are some works on 2D integrable models, also by Cardi Doyon from London. And then, obviously, there's a story about a relation to C theorems and what is called modular theory that's also being used here. Some well-known works of Cassini and Huerta, and there's a huge body, of course, of ideas how to do calculations in holography. So I didn't want to say that I don't like this. I just wanted to give you, because you probably have all the experts here, so you don't have to learn it from me. I just wanted to give you, maybe tell you something that you don't, is not maybe commonly emphasized so much. So maybe that was kind of the idea. Anyway, there is a huge body of work, and Hubney has had some ideas how to make this covariant. Rob Myers from here, too many people to name. Anyway, I wanted to pay my respects to this, and I think I've now done this, and perhaps with this officially conclude the talk, and then maybe afterwards we can, since it's my time is up, maybe afterwards we can discuss perhaps with a few people is those related to replica stuff and so on.
Questions? Comments?
So, just to remind myself, you used Arrakis relative entropy, right?
Yeah, so I mean, the relative entropy that was is known in classical probability theory for a long time, and then Omegaki in 1960 or something. But Araki said, understood that this is not just restricted to type one, but he said you explain how to do it in a more in the setup that I needed. So that, and he proved a lot of things about a lot of properties that are important here. That's why I mentioned Araki.
But that is the measure that you.
Right, so you say that you have a state and a bipartite system, and you say how far is this state from the subset of all separable states? Yeah, so that's the idea. So here, in the state space, there are already separable states. They form some sort of subset, and if I have some arbitrary state here, I'm asking what is this distance? Because if the state itself is separable, then its entanglement is zero by definition. And so then you have to ask what kind of distance do you put, and here this is separable, what kind of distance are you going to put here? It has to be a distance which is going to decrease if you apply a separable operation to your state. And then that reduces the number of possibilities you have for this distance. And it turns out this relative entropy does it all for you. And it's defined, unlike many others, it's defined in this type 3 case. So that's why I basically use it. And it's also related to modular theory. That's what's behind the machines, behind this Tomita Takasaki. So it also helps me to do my estimation.
Can you say something about relating this to cutoffs? Morally, they're the same, but is there any sense? Because
well, yeah, so that's
about cutoffs, you think in terms of modes and, you know, UV cutoffs and high frequency modes being cut off and so on.
Yeah.
Typically.
Okay, so yeah, so I think it's related, but I don't really. So let's say, so my understanding of what people often do is that they have, well, basically they want to say A is this and B is the complement. And then they say, okay, of course they all understand that this will diverge. And so they say, well, let's go to a system where you have impose a cutoff. And so most cleanly, of course, it's done on a lattice where you just have some lattice points and they have a finite distance. And then you get a density matrix that depends on the lattice cutoff. And then you can go to the reduced density matrix and define the von Neumann entropy of this, and you say this is then your this is your entanglement, and of course people understand it's going to diverge. Now, what are you going to do to get something finite? Of course, you can say you're going to take away the leading terms, for instance, and then you have to ask yourself whether that's always universal or state-dependent, state-independent. But I think your question is how this would be related to, let's say, a situation where I calculate the entanglement in my way, but I leave here a distance of size lambda inverse. And so what is not clear to me is that there will be the same quantities, I think. So this would be the R of this, but now the cutoff is not in the theory, but the cutoff is in the regions. And so the thing is, so there are some investigations. So for instance, it's generally unclear to me. And so why I like this way is because this is, you say you just accept that there is a finite distance between them, and then this has all these monotonicity properties, whereas if you pull first, of course, with a lattice cutoff, this also has monotonicity properties, but then the lattice cutoff is not usually compatible with relativistic invariance, of course. And if you put a momentum cutoff, then it's not consistent with locality because you wash it out a little bit. And so I think probably there is this, maybe this relation, but I'm not really sure because they're a little bit a different thing. Another thing people do is to compute a mutual information where you say, okay, rather than doing this, you kind of form this mutual information where also the divergences are supposed to cancel each other. But again, if you have a non-pure state, the mutual information also is not a good entanglement measure because it can be non-zero for separable states. That's the point. So of course this way with the von Neumann, that's very nice because you can use the replica trick and you can actually calculate something. What I wanted to emphasize is to start in a setting where you manifestly have these monotonicity properties and what you can do there. That was kind of my point.
Any other questions?
So you would expect that in the vacuum state in these two regions, the mutual information and the measure that you present is relative entropy would give the same result?
No, I don't. Well, mine doesn't really give a finite result if the regions touch each other. So I think it's a bit unclear. I think I looked a bit. So Cardi, for instance, he has calculated things like this for two regions with a finite distance. And I checked a little bit into against my asymptotics, and it did not really seem to be exactly the same, but of course only have upper bounds. It's a bit unclear to me. But anyway, I'm pointing out, at any rate, if you have a mixed state, if the regions have a finite difference, or if your state is not a vacuum, but a thermal state or any other, basically, then anyhow you have all this big zoo of measures that are all on the same footing, really. Do not give the same answer. Something known to quantum information.
Some comments from
Peter.
Again.